From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There wasn't just one issue that defined the legislative session this year. As always, there was a lot going on. Lawmakers were dealing with a probe of former Attorney General John Swallow, with Utahns demanding they do something about air quality, with an effort to reform the political caucus system, not to mention a squabble between the Speaker of the House and the governor. Today in the program, we're talking about what happened on Utah's Capitol Hill this year. We'll talk about the $13.5 billion budget, about education, about liquor laws, about Medicaid funding, gay rights. There's also cockfighting in the state tree and other things as well. A lot to talk about, really. We hope you'll join us today with your own questions or comments on the 2014 legislative session. After the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Utah lawmakers wrapped up their 2014 legislative session last night. It was a session marked by the usual moments of political drama and compromise, though it doesn't seem there was just one issue that defined the session this year. Today in the program, we're looking back on the session at the bills that passed and those that didn't. There's a lot to talk about. Many of you are thinking about air quality and education and health care. We'll get to that, as well as the efforts to reform the political system in the state, to protect the rights of gay people and child abuse victims, to get rid of the Zion Curtain. A lot to get to, actually. We're hoping that you'll be a part of the conversation today. What did you make of this year's session? What were the issues you were paying attention to this year, and how do you figure lawmakers did this year? We welcome your comments and questions at 801-585-WEST, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. You can also join us on Facebook and on Twitter. Joining us on the program is Holly Richardson. She's just walking in, as a matter of fact, as we speak. Former state representative, conservative blogger, and current candidate, we should say, for Utah's 57th Legislative District.
And good morning.
Welcome. Thanks for being with us. Robert Gerke is with us, reports on government for the Salt Lake Tribune. Robert, welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
We have Max Roth back with us, a reporter, anchor for Fox 13 News. Max covers the State House as well as other things. Max, welcome back.
Thrilled to be here.
Glad you're with us. And Brian Grimmett with us, I think for the first time, right, Brian?
Yes, the very first time. I'm excited.
Again, a reporter for KUER News. He's been covering the legislative session along with the rest of them over there in the newsroom. Welcome.
Kind of tag team coverage.
Yeah, a lot of it. Okay, so let's. I wanted to start first of all with sort of what you may all have perceived as, if there were any kind of. I mentioned there wasn't any one, at least as I saw it, defining issue. Was there a theme, Max Roth? Was there some sort of theme that played out?
You know, it's not often in Utah governance. We see in Utah politics these big debates, but. With the governing bodies seeing one of the leaders take on another so overtly, I think set the tone.
Now let's explain what you're talking about. You're talking about Speaker
Becky Lockhart. The first day of the session, she made a speech that clearly went after the governor, calling him an inaction figure.
Did that really elicit gasps? I read that somewhere.
Yeah. It did. I mean, there were people who were visibly shocked by that, and then there was applause from the
House itself.
Sorry, keep going, Max.
Oh no, and then she continued by drawing a line on taking money from the Affordable Care Act, saying she was completely opposed to that, and then presented this $300 million proposal to get iPads, other kinds of technology into classrooms. So she set a bar there,
yeah,
and that really was something that carried through the session with everyone thinking, okay, what's going on with this relationship?
Well, what was going on with the relationship, Robert Gierke? Was it her – I mean, there's some talk that she wanted to run against him in 2016.
It's I think, largely assumed that she's is carefully considering a run in 2016. She's not ruling it out. She's not saying she's doing it, but I think there's an assumption that she's at least interested in it. And she wanted to put her mark on this session. She wanted – it's her last session, 16 years in the legislature. She wanted to kind of put a stake in the ground and say, here's where I think we need to go. And in the process, you take on the governor, and it creates – that provided the context, as Max said, for everything else that transpired this session, I think. And after the dust settled, as we wrote today, I think you look back on it, there's really no way – to characterize it other than the governor won on most every issue, I think.
I agree.
Think, yeah.
I love the speaker. And I really like Gary Wright. I like them both. I was surprised also that it was so direct from the opening speech. That surprised me.
And Herbert, of course, makes a reference to it, sort of an oblique one in his State of the State address.
Yeah. Well, he hasn't been that oblique, actually.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, he just referred... I think it was yesterday or even the day before on Twitter, he was talking about being an action figure, not inaction, right? Yeah, I mean, so he's obviously responding. But of course, he
also told the Tribune, this is no big deal.
But I thought there were two tracks. So that did set the tone, and it aligned. Usually you get the House and the Senate, even though there's some tension between them, you get the two of them pushing back against the executive branch. This time, what I saw was the House was by itself and the Senate aligned with the governor and said, hey, buddy, we got your back, right? I mean, and that's what it felt like. That's what it seemed like. But there was another track as well that was the Kumbaya track where so you set aside the really big issues that the speaker and the governor were tangling over. And there were I think there were only a couple. Medicaid was one of them and the one-to-one initiative was the other one. But then you had some of these really difficult issues that people have been working on for a really long time. Autism. There's a package of autism bills that passed this year. There are several other things where they said, okay, let's just work it out. And I think to a large degree, a lot of them did. And that was, I thought, was very good.
And just to push back a little bit, if I may, this idea that the governor won is
okay. I didn't say that.
I wonder exactly how much the base of the Republican Party would believe that, because nothing happened with Medicaid. And when you talk about the ideological battle of this session, where you had the governor and the Senate aligned against the House, one wanting to take federal money, one not wanting to. Clearly, the House is the one that coming out of the session, there's no program, and they didn't want this Affordable Care Act money coming in.
Robert Gierke, you talk about that because you also mentioned that it's true Governor Herbert did not win on this issue, but he does have a little bit of leeway now to deal with the Obama administration.
Right. I mean, basically, it became pretty clear several weeks into the session that they weren't going to come to any agreement on Medicaid. The House had staked out its plan. The Senate was kind of going in a different direction by having a hard time getting its people together. And then the governor throws his plan out there that goes even further. What you've got is the House, who wants to use $35 million in state money, draw down about $80 million in federal dollars, and provide basically just pay out-of-pocket health care for a lot of the very, very poor people. We don't know how many it would cover, but for the very, very poor people, just pay for their coverage. You have the Senate, who wants to pay for subsidized insurance for those who are making up to about $11,600 a year, which is also pretty poor, I think, by any standard. Mm-hmm. And then you have the governor, who comes out with a plan that is much larger. He would use $250 million in federal money. This is money that he says Utahns are paying under the Affordable Care Act to the federal government. So take that back, use that to subsidize insurance on the private market for those who are making up to 130% of poverty. It's 111,000 people who are making under $15,500 a year. So those are the three plans that are on the table. And it became really clear with about midway through the session that they're not going to be able to reconcile these plans. Yeah. So at the end of the day, what the governor's left with is he's left a lot of latitude because they didn't put any parameters on what the legislature was willing to sign off on. He's going to go back to Washington. He's going to have his staff go back Monday. He's going to be going back next month to start negotiating with the Obama administration to try to work out, as he calls it, the best – negotiate the best deal he can. He said he would like to have had a go-get-him cowboy, as he put it, in a typical Garyism, I guess. But he's – you know, he didn't get that, but now he has free run of the field, really. And he's got to come back and sell it to the legislature after he negotiates it. But that's an issue for another day. I think we'll probably be a few months down the road before we see that. In the meantime, of course, these people who would otherwise have been covered are not going to have any health insurance, and that could create problems.
Brian Greenman, I want to get your sense of that, the dynamic between the governor and the speaker. The speaker said last night she could take a punch. She clearly knows that she did, right? And that, but she had no regrets. She's told the Salt Lake Tribune. But do you have a sense of how much damage that actually may have done to her political campaign?
Like was already mentioned before, it's kind of hard to tell what that will actually do among kind of the base and the people who usually the delegates who will vote for this in 2016. The speaker, you know, as all good politicians do in the last week, even though she kind of recognized, even when she was conceding that the education, you know, her one-to-one initiative isn't getting funded, she conceded that wasn't happened. She spun that to make it, you know, seem like, hey, I'm trying to do something here. And the governor's kind of getting in the way of us doing what really needs to, you know, be getting done. So while she was kind of conceding, you know, that it didn't happen, she was trying to kind of turn it into her favor, saying, look at this. This is another example of, you know, Governor Herbert not moving forward quickly enough on an issue that needs to be addressed. And then, you know, Governor Herbert comes out and says, well, this has been a priority for us for several years and we're thinking about it. And so it's just kind of this who's really right and what's actually going to happen, you know, in the end. And I think that's kind of where that dynamic is, you know, even though you see it as her not getting it, she's at least attempting in her best way possible to turn it in her favor, saying, I was trying to do something.
But is she right? Will there at some point emerge somewhere on the order of, if it's not 300, you know, what you'd need is hundreds of millions of dollars to get these digital tablets in the hands of, I guess, as she wants it, every single school child in the school system. I mean, is that an inevitable thing?
I think it is, actually. And I've been out in my area talking to all of the principals in the schools there, and we talked about this initiative, and every one of them says this is where the future's going. We are going there. They weren't necessarily all on board with $300 million right out of the gate, but every single one of them, without exception, has said this is where we need to go. We know it. We know that we need the infrastructure, and the speaker's plan had a three-part rollout, right? One was infrastructure. The second step was teacher development. And then the third step was the actual devices. And so we are going there. And I think that they really pushed the conversation, you know, to your point, Brian, but that they pushed the conversation to say this, we want to be leaders in this arena. We know it's coming. We know that there's ways to not do it well. We want to be able to do it well. And I think that you will see probably even the next session. It's probably not going to be as large, but you will see some progress.
Wait, so was it the governor just being petulant?
Well, to put it into context, you have, you know, the House, the Senate, they love pilot projects.
Yeah.
They get these big ideas. And they throw it out there, $300 million, and then it ends up being, well, let's try it out in a few schools. We'll get a little bit of money. And that offer was on the table. The Senate said, you know what? We can find $26 million to start trying this out. Let's let some districts apply for the money to put it into some classrooms. They can work out the bugs rather than – and what the governor was saying is, hey – if you spend $300 million, you buy however many iPads that buys, and you throw it at teachers who have not had any training on how to do it, how to implement it in the classroom, then suddenly you just have a whole bunch of, you know, coasters and
right,
classroom.
And that was never the proposal, right? Mm-hmm. It never was just let's go buy a bunch of iPads or tablets and toss them at the kids. That never was. That's the third step in the three-part process, but.
Mm-hmm. If I could, there are probably two things. I mean, there's no question this was a pretty bold and even potentially revolutionary proposal from the speaker. The criticism of it that we heard from senators and from representatives as well is that she didn't do the spade work. She didn't lay the groundwork with other members of the body to put this out there. She brings it out in the second week of the session. Her Senate sponsor, she met with him just a couple days before she announced it. Mm-hmm. Everybody was kind of surprised by this. And then the price tag on it, it was, whoa, where are we going to get that kind of money?
And they were scared about losing their money.
And they were, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's going to necessitate taking money from every other program. And she said that at the outset. And so there wasn't the spade work that was done really to necessary to roll something out this big.
And doesn't she in that case then hand the governor a weapon?
Well, and that's what the – and he took it. He took it and he used it. He said, you know, we need to – the governor has been studying this issue as well, and they came out with a number that said this is going to be $700 million to $1 billion to fully implement this program. We don't know what she wants to do. If it comes in more than $30 million, I'm going to veto it, which is a pretty unusual thing for the Governor Herbert to do, a direct veto threat like that. And so, you know, I think it did kind of set him up. And then, of course, as Holly mentioned, you had the Senate and the governor on the same page on this. And it isolated the speaker from even some in her own caucus, you know, that were not on board with this. So it left her with very little wiggle room. Now, politically, you ask the question, politically, I think this was the speaker. She's on her way out. It was sort of her chance to form a legacy project that she could use as a platform or a springboard in 2016, and failed to do that. And not only that, I think, you know, the governor, with his high popularity rating, she could have put a dent in that popularity rating. And again, I don't know that was necessarily accomplished.
Utah lawmakers spent $4 million on their probe of former Attorney General John Swallow. Wednesday, they released the report. It was some 206 pages, I guess it was, 3,700 exhibits. Give us a sense, Max Roth, what did it say?
Well, let me start on page one. That was
How
the title,
long do you
now,
have?
Robert. It went into four different areas, and the first two are the most important. And the first two were first saying, and it used this wording that John Swallow put a for sale sign on the Attorney General's office, and it outlined three instances where they thought that happened: Jeremy Johnson, the St. George businessman, and the alleged scheme to get money for a bribe to Senator Harry Reid in Washington. Then they talked about this couple in Holiday who had hosted a campaign fundraiser for Swallow and who had mortgage issues of their own. Their mortgage issues were settled by the Bank of America, and then the Attorney General's office dropped a lawsuit against Bank of America that was on behalf of thousands of Utahns who were having trouble with their mortgages. The third, I'm having a Governor Perry moment.
The payday lenders, his connection with the payday lenders.
Yeah, the payday lenders, of course.
Well, I think we need to – let's fold into the revelations. We don't need to go through it in the particulars, but a broader sense of what exactly happened I think might be helpful, and we need to fold into the conversation the revelations in the story that may involve Utah Senator Mike Lee. You mentioned Harry Reid. Robert, your paper is reporting, according to this report, Senator Lee is tied to Swallow's campaign fundraising efforts.
Yeah, there was a section in the report where it talked a little bit about efforts, John's involvement, former Attorney General Swallow's involvement in raising money for Mike Lee. And making connections between Jeremy Johnson and some of Jeremy Johnson's supporters in the Lee campaign. In fact, there was almost $10,000 worth of checks that actually bounced it, and that was sort of one of the revelations. You know, the Lee campaign is not commenting on this. And then further, today's report was that the prosecutors, the county prosecutors who are investigating Attorney General John Swallow, and it was part of their criminal investigation, were questioning why the U.S. Department of Justice pulled out in September. They shut down their investigation and walked away. The FBI has continued to work with these county prosecutors. And so they were questioning why they did that and suggested that maybe these revelations that have come out of the report and come out of their investigation
bear looking into, because they don't have the resources, these county prosecutors.
No. I mean, they're strapped, and this has been an investigation that goes back to late 2012. They've been working on this thing.
And something to buttress that claim of theirs that the federal prosecutors pulled out early is that from the beginning, the FBI was pushing for this investigation, and in this very unusual situation that continues, are doing some of the legwork ongoing in this investigation despite the Department of Justice dropping it. And so they feel like, hey, the FBI thinks there's something there. Why did you drop it this early?
And that was one of the interesting things, I think, in the report as well, is there was a section in the report that I wasn't personally expecting, was where they laid out potential state criminal violations and also pointed to some potential federal criminal violations that stemmed from the findings that they had. You know, obviously we don't know exactly what those county prosecutors are looking at, but it did lay out a pretty clear roadmap if they were wanting to pursue that.
I think what I find interesting in the Swallow probe is whether or not it provided incentive for lawmakers to move finally, because they've been been asked to move on terms of ethics and campaign finance reform, those kinds of things. What it did to get lawmakers to actually act on all of that. Holly, what do you think?
It did. I mean, I think it was pretty clear. Most of the legislation that was a direct result of the Swallow investigation sailed through both bodies. Some of it was unanimous. Some of it was not. But I think, you know, Representative Mike McKell, when they did their unveiling, he was on the investigative committee, and when they did their two-day report in December, I was up there for that as they discussed it. And one of the things that he said was, he was personally shocked and stunned to find out that this was going on in Utah, that he had the idea that it didn't go on, right? And so I think that I think to Utah's credit, we haven't had this level of issue to investigate before, and that there's a large number of people who think that it didn't exist. There are some who think that everybody does it, right? But I had some people within the Republican Party say to me, why are you so hard on John Swallow? This is just what everybody does. And my response, of course, was, what makes you think this would be okay, right? Even as status quo, of course that's not okay. And so I think once they realized that there was a problem, they were willing to act and to fix it. Before, if you're thinking it's just theoretical and there's not really a problem, what problem are you trying to fix? You hear that all the time. What problem is this legislation trying to fix? Well, it became clear what problem it was trying to fix, and I think that was one of the reasons it just passed.
Brian Grimmon, I want to get you on this, because you think these ethics bills that have come out of the Swallow investigation, they're significant. They're a big deal.
Yeah, no, they and it's interesting that, you know, they were able to pass these bills that directly affect themselves so much with how much they're supposed to report on their campaign finance reports. And all of them were directly – it was almost taking, here's what Swallow did, and now we're telling you that you can't do this. You know, mm-hmm. One of the things they changed was that money that candidates give to like a political consultant – say they give, you know, $50,000 to this political consultant. Instead of just saying that, they have to outline, well, what did that political consultant – do with that money? Did he spend $10,000 on flyers, you know, $20,000 on mailers? Mm-hmm. And so it's trying to kind of take away this ability to obscure what you're actually doing just by saying, oh, well, yeah, I expended this much money, but, you know, I paid it to this one guy. And what he mm-hmm. did, you know, nobody knows. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that they helped eliminate it. And they're going to have to think about it more when they're filling out their forms. And especially one of the other things was a conflict of interest. Yeah. They have to report for a greater period of time before they file, you know, what businesses they held interest in and that kind of thing. And some of the concerns were, is this going to be too onerous for the candidates? But eventually they did end up making those changes.
So Max, net gain or net loss in terms of ethics reforms enacted? I mean, Utah does remain one of the only four states where mm-hmm. there are no campaign donation limits.
Yeah, and I think that is very significant. They say that you know, light is the best disinfectant, and you know that most legislators, when you talk to them about this, buy into the idea that money is speech, and so you can't restrict the amount of money that comes into a candidate. But the idea that any one group, and you see it in so many different settings. I think about the governor's annual gala where you'll have sponsors, advertising sponsors, who are giving $20,000, $30,000, in some cases $50,000 just openly to a campaign. And it's hard to imagine how that doesn't get you a thank you and maybe a conversation and some access. It's I just don't know how that would not influence how you feel about somebody. But that being said, I think the most significant thing that came out of the Swallow investigation was the Swallow investigation. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that the House put together a group mm-hmm. that used subpoena power and sicked private investigators on people is substantial and is a big change to the tone mm-hmm. on the Hill. And it's you know, because as Robert was looking into things and did such amazing work at the outset of this story and ongoing through, I did as much as I could to look into campaign finances. We couldn't subpoena the consultants and the other records to find out about this black money. Right. So you looked at those records and thought, why aren't payday lenders giving him anything? This is very strange because that's the industry he comes from. Mm-hmm. And then you find out as the House starts investigating,
almost $500,000.
Yeah, they gave him a ton of money, but it wasn't to him. It was to these black groups.
I think Max is exactly right. I mean, we've done all the reporting we can do on it, but people say, oh, that's just media stirring the pot, whatever. It's easy for them to dismiss, and we heard that a lot from the representatives. This was the first time DOJ investigated, but we don't know what they found because they never reported it. The LG investigated, but they looked at a very narrow section. The Bar Association investigated, but we don't know what they found. This is the first time it's been sort of all laid on the table for everybody to see and see what transpired. And I think a lot of representatives, even some who questioned the validity or the necessity of this investigation, were shocked by it.
I think most, right? But not all. I mean, there's still a remaining sentiment a little bit that it was a politically motivated witch hunt and there's nothing there.
Well,
3,700 pages.
I don't know
later.
If I should mention another radio show on our radio show, but I was listening to Doug Wright a little bit on my way in, and Mark Shurtleff was on this morning, and Doug Wright asked him a little bit about the investigation, and Mark Shurtleff, who was the Attorney General before John Swallow, who is kind of also somewhat implicated in these things, said, you know, the report is completely one-sided, and we weren't even asked what our take was. But, you know, some of them were and they refused to talk to the investigation through their attorneys. So there is, you know, a lot of people out there who are still saying, well, this is
– I don't
this,
know if there's
this
a lot,
proof.
But there are some.
There's some. There's some.
Yeah, there are. There are some.
We need to move on and take a break, as a matter of fact. We have with us Holly Richardson, who is former state representative, conservative blogger with us. Robert Gerke, of course, reports on government for the Salt Lake Tribune. Max Roth with us, reporter and anchor for Fox 13 News. Brian Grimmett, reporter for KUER News. And you can join us if you like. Comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a really quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking about Utah's 2014 legislative session. Ended last night. We have with us a panel of observers of the process here to help us make sense of what happened and what may not have happened. Holly Richardson back with us. Robert Gerke, Max Roth, Bryant Grimmett, 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Air quality. It's one of those things that was there seemed to be the sort of critical mass of concern that happened, especially during the really crappy air in January. What happened ultimately? Robert Gerke, start. What finally did they do?
It ended anything? Up being a little bit of a mixed bag because you're right. I mean, whenever the air is bad, it's a top priority. And then the air clears up around March and everybody kind of forgets about it a little bit. There were some major bills that were passed. And I think one of the big ones is the they're trying to phase out wood burning stoves. Yeah. There are 200 people in these non-attainment areas that their sole source of heat is wood-burning stoves. And burning one of these stoves for an hour is, they say, according to the University of Utah research, the same as driving your car from Salt Lake to St. George and back. So it's a tremendous amount of pollution, and they think if they can phase these out, they're going to provide an economic incentive for it. $750,000 to phase these out and to do an education campaign, and they think that they can take a big chunk out of the pollutants that way. There were a few other bills. There were incentives for purchase of electric vehicles. There were some incentives for businesses, solar businesses, to sort of develop and produce cleaner energy. There were also a number of bills that failed, and so there were the things that the proponents, the clean air proponents, were making a priority. The things like allowing cities and counties to raise sales taxes so they can convert to, so they can expand mass transit. That one failed in the House. There was the proposal for the state to be able to enact tougher air quality regulations than the EPA has in place, and that one didn't get out of the Senate.
Then they passed a bill that that asks the Environmental Protection Agency to find a way to allow coal burning electricity plants to continue to operate.
Yeah, it ends up being a little schizophrenic, I guess, coal is a big industry, especially in central Utah, and there are representatives who are going to defend that to their last breath, I guess. But it ends up being a little bit of a mixed bag. I will say that I think this is probably – they probably did more this year on air quality than I have seen them do in the past. I don't know, Holly or Max, if you have – or Brian.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think you're right.
I think they did too. And, you know, I think there's some perception that the legislature is not doing anything at all. But the reality is they do keep trying to chip away at it and chip away at it and chip away at it. And the air quality is better now than it was a decade ago. I think people are aware and it's something that they'll continue to work on.
I think one of the concerns that some people brought up, some of the air quality advocates brought up, and not like completely, but is that while there was a lot of talk about it and they're excited for that and they're excited that there was anything, you know, passed, mm-hmm. that they're concerned a little bit about what if the bills that were actually passed actually do much to help, you know, eliminate air quality. Like some of them, they do, but how much does it actually do?
Well, this is a massive dispute in which we could spend hours on, and that is what really causes – I mean, there's a question of what role industry is actually playing because there's this
– Where's the problem and how do you address that?
And you have a legislature that largely does not believe in regulation. And so you get bills that are about incentives trying to find the carrot right. instead of the stick. Mm-hmm. And a lot of folks don't think that's going to be effective.
How did lawmakers deal with the gay marriage issue? All of this, of course, playing out in the wake of the December ruling by federal judge Robert Shelby striking down Utah's gay marriage ban, what kind of action did you see or inaction?
I can tell you what they did. They didn't do anything.
They punted.
Mm-hmm.
They're good at that. They've punted on immigration. They've punted on lots of things.
It was a decision. It was a decision from the start because of Judge Robert Shelby's decision regarding Amendment 3. They said it was too emotional. Too emotional an issue this year to deal with these non-discrimination bills. And then there were also Senator Stuart Reed was trying to pass a religious liberty bill, which was on the other side of
– Which was like Arizona's.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And
but you know, I want to actually ask you about that because Reed's concern seems to be, you know, what are the effects of these gay rights – this gay rights trend, if I can put it this way, or this movement, it seems to be headed that way anyway. What is that effect going to be on religious liberty? Right. Is that what you're going to be seeing in terms of from lawmakers? Is that kind of reaction? Do you have a sense?
It's almost sort of the last bastion, right? I mean, because it's you're not going to have institutional discrimination against gay and lesbian people anymore, but there's still this feeling that there needs to be a protection for my own personal mm-hmm. I don't know beliefs
right
and that necessitates in some instances you know rejecting services to gay and lesbian couples as they you know as we saw in Arizona right. New Mexico Washington these different incidents come up where I don't want to make wedding cakes for gay marriages I don't want to be a photographer for gay marriages and I should be able to reject that. Senator Reed says that this is sort of the two can't coexist. You can't have on one hand somebody's religious beliefs to let somebody exercise their religious beliefs freely and have these rights that the courts, he says, have created for gay and lesbian couples. And he says there's a tension, a conflict there that just simply can't coexist. And he's adamant that he's going to stand his ground against the creep of the gay culture.
What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where the conversation is headed. As the legal battle unfolds, I mean, I think that we'll see more clearly. I think before the Judge Shelby ruling, however, that non-discrimination ordinance by Senator Urquhart was well on its way to passing. I think he had garnered the support and that he was going to be able to probably get it through this session. And then
didn't pass. They ditched it. 13 protesters went to.
They didn't even discuss it, right?
And they tabled it really, really early on in the session because they took all of those bills like that, and including the religious freedom one and all of those, and they just said, we're not even touching it.
Will that be back?
It certainly will be.
Senator Urquhart, I talked to him on the last night of the session and asked him what he feels like.
Significantly, we're talking about a Republican from St. George.
Republican from St. George, yeah. It's one of the first times. And it's interesting his evolution on this. He says his daughter joined the Gay Straight Alliance in his school, and he met her friends, and it was a learning experience for him, and he's trying to bring other people through that process as well. But he says he thinks the meeting that I think Max referenced, where they brought in a bunch of gay individuals, lesbian individuals, transgender individuals to kind of tell their stories mm-hmm. In an informal setting where a lot of legislators were there, he said he thinks that created a lot of goodwill, opened up a lot of people's eyes and their minds, and he thinks that they've moved the ball significantly this session on that issue, and it'll be back.
I think that's key on any issue, especially ones that become controversial, and you can, you know, pivot to the autism community as well. But when you start to realize there are real people and real lives, and you stop with the name calling from both sides, right, potentially, but if you're the legislator and people are calling you names, you know, you never listen, you always do this, you never do that, whatever, it's not real conducive to healthy dialogue. But when you have people come in and say, look, this is what we experience, kind of related, but I have adopted children and some of them are black. I have adult black children now, men, young men, they're 21. Do you know that they get pulled over all the time? Why? Because they're black men driving in a car. And they know that they are very careful, but they have some profiling going on. It's something that I don't experience, but I know that my kids do.
Will you say something, Holly, and maybe the rest of you, just briefly as we head into a break, on this autism bill? We got a comment from Elisa, who writes, as a mother of a young child with autism, I want to thank our lawmakers from the bottom of my heart for passing not one but two autism programs for our children this year.
You know, if someone were to ask me what's the biggest thing that came out of this session, I'd say SB 57, that autism bill. What it does is it tells large insurers for large companies and large insurers that provide individual policies, private insurers, that they have to provide coverage for children from ages 2 to 9 in these services. And anytime – it's Elisa there. Anytime you talk with somebody who has gotten an autism diagnosis, they find out that they have this lifelong struggle ahead of them, and then they find out also that they're financially ruined so much of the time because it's $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 a year with no insurance coverage. And it's and there are thousands of parents across the state who have bankrupted themselves, taken second jobs, and this is – it's a big deal, and they've been fighting for this since 2008 is
long
when
time.
I saw the first bill on this up there.
Yeah, a long time. And, you know, I think there were three bills actually. So you had the that one that you just mentioned. We also had the one that extended the pilot program and made it permanent now. But you also had the one with the cannabis, right? So the hemp oil extract to treat children with intractable seizures. But a lot of those kids are also co-diagnosed with autism. And so it's an additional factor. I mean, it's a very small population. But I have to be honest, I did not think that they were, those moms, passionate as they were, I did not think they were going to be able to get that through in one session. And they did, because they were willing to just keep working and talking and changing the language of the bill to get it to exactly what they needed. It's not broad. This is not easily accessed, right? But specifically for those kids who need it. And so, you know, kudos to the legislature for looking at real families' lives. I mean, it's difficult, right? Which is what? Where does the role of government begin and end?
I think it goes back a little bit with the hemp, the cannabis oil, the hemp extract bill, to what you were saying even about the LGBT bill and that meeting, how it opened things up. Senator Valentine,
when it
gets on
personal.
Senator Valentine on the floor when he was talking about how he came to kind of accept this bill and vote for it, talked about those mothers with their children and the way that they were trying to get legislators to pass this. He said he really appreciated the way that they went about doing it. And I think that's kind of where they're getting with some of the LGBT activists as well. But it takes that. It takes the right touch, I guess, to get these legislators to do what you want them to do.
On that cannabis bill, they've named it Charlie's Law for a little girl named Charlie, who last night on Facebook about midnight, they posted that her hospice nurse has said she only had hours to live. Right, it was too late for her. But as a mother of kids with disabilities, you get to a point where you would try to do anything you could to help your child. And the reality is they were trying to do it through legal channels. They wanted to change the law to make it legal instead of, you know, going on the black market or whatever.
Holly Richardson, former state representative and conservative blogger with us. That's Brian Grimmett, also reporter, of course, for KUER. We have Max Roth with us, reporter, anchor for Fox 13 News. And Robert Gerke here from the Salt Lake Tribune, who reports on the government and other things. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. The This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about Utah's 2014 legislative session, which ended last night, talking about what happened or what didn't happen. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So let's talk about what happened related to sort of this ongoing effort to reform Utah's liquor laws. And the one thing that seems to be sort of staying in place is, of course, this seven-some-odd-foot barrier called the Zion Curtain at these new restaurants. And I guess we've talked about this issue on the on this program before, a few weeks ago, in fact, when the LDS Church got involved to say essentially things are fine where they are. Mm-hmm. And that, I guess, Robert Gerke, that sort of put an end to it.
It sort of did. I mean, there were still efforts in the House to get a bill through.
It would have passed in the House, someone said, didn't it?
Yeah, it would have passed easily in the House.
It did last year, too.
Yeah, and you know—
It's always the Senate.
The Senate was already kind of opposed to it, and I think the church's statement on it made it that much more difficult for them to get it moving in the Senate, and it just never saw the light of day.
Well, here's John Valentine. He was quoted in the paper, your paper. Candidly, the capstone was when the LDS Church came out in very strong support of the Senate's position. So sort of a concession that was the end of it.
Yeah, it's nice to just say it openly.
well, and it just seems that
as
long as Senator Valentine is in charge of what bills make it to the floor in the Senate, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. You did see, I mean, there was a bill on breathalyzers. I think that was the only liquor-related legislation that passed.
So is liquor reform, is it over? Is this it?
Well,
is it over?
It's politics, man.
This is Utah.
which is not to say there won't be efforts. The question is that as – if the LDS Church is saying that's as far as you should go, is that as far as they will go?
Well, you know, we've seen the LDS Church evolving over time, changing on some things. You look at the non-discrimination laws, and they entered that debate on a side that no one expected. So who knows what happens?
It's interesting that the sponsor of a lot of the reform legislation, Representative Ryan Wilcox from Ogden, announced last night that he's going to be resigning from the legislature this week to go work for Mike Lee. So in one sense, the champion of that bill of those bills is gone. But I think there will be others. Gage for
this is Representative Craig Powell. Yeah.
Yeah. Who will kind of step up, and I think it's going to be an evolving process, though.
Mm-hmm. The way Governor Gary Herbert put it, we actually asked him a little bit about this yesterday, was that he just feels that he said in one of his colloquialisms, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And he said that's basically what the LDS Church was saying, whether it is or not, I guess, up for debate. But he was saying, you know, until we, I guess, have more reason to change it, it should just stay the same, stay the way it is.
Let me ask about education. How did education fare this year? Robert Gerke, you want to start?
They did very well. I mean, depending on whose numbers you use, either roughly 60% of all of the new funding that was in the state budget went to education. They funded all of the growth, more than 10,000 new students that are going to be going to schools. They increased the per pupil spending by 2.5%, which is about $60 million statewide. Yeah. There were a number of smaller programs, things like the pre-K program that, targeting at-risk youth and making sure that there's early intervention in some of those homes in those cases where it's necessary. Senator Hilliard, who's the Senate Budget Chairman, said education is and always will be our number one priority. And Gary Herbert said in the interviews he was doing last night that he's proud of the way that they focused on education and made it their number one priority. It's always one of the top priorities. Now, whether this gets us beyond treading water, because you're funding growth, but you're funding growth at the current levels.
Right.
You're putting money into increasing the WPU, but most of that goes into health insurance and retirement for the teachers. So whether we're going to actually be raising the bar on education is an open question, I think.
I think it's really important, and the Utah Foundation made this point to me, but that when you're talking about when you hear $345 million new dollars to education, the lion's share of that is funding growth, and funding growth means you have a third child in the family and you decide you'll buy them clothes too. You're going to pay for the kids who are there. So you kind of want to subtract that and then see what was added.
The effort to reform the state's caucus system was an effort called Count My Vote. They had already spent a considerable amount of money. and time, they suspended their efforts when lawmakers agreed to make some changes. How significant was that, Holly, do you think? You were opposed to it. We had you
huge
on the program talking about it.
Well, I actually supported the original SB 54, right, and as it changed, as it morphed. I think it's huge, and I think the idea that it doesn't fundamentally change the election system in Utah is flawed. I think it does change it fundamentally.
In a good way?
I think open participation, more participation is always a good thing. It remains to be seen, right? But as you change things, you do have the moneyed interests that can come in. I'm not independently wealthy. It makes it difficult for me to run against somebody who is independently wealthy.
But that seems like that's the critical. That's the biggest critical aspect of it, or
that's
the
right.
biggest criticism of it, is that only establishment candidates who have access to a lot of money are going to be
able
to.
It's not only, but it gives them an advantage,
okay.
right? I mean, that's not the only determination. You can get support in many ways. One of them is financial, and the larger your race is geographically, the more important that becomes. But, the reality is I think we are going to see a fundamental shift in how we elect our representatives in Utah.
What do you guys think? Because I wonder what happens to the convention system now? I mean, why would you put yourself through that if you didn't have to?
Well, if you're Holly and you don't have a whole lot of money, then it's the way to get on the ballot.
Yeah.
But if you do have a whole lot of money, and if you're say a John Huntsman deciding to jump back into the political
That's
fray,
right.
probably not going to get through a convention, a Republican convention, but
That's right.
but could easily win an election if he got signatures and got on a ballot.
And well, he could get the signatures.
And most of the candidates or most of the legislators who've talked about this have said they might do both.
That's right.
Right? You can go through the convention system and then have a backup plan, I guess, a plan
mm-hmm.
B.
That's right.
But there are also candidates, I think, who are more tailored, I guess, to the convention process, and they're going to run to the party's base and try to get the nomination that way, and hope that they don't get a. The governor said there were several legislators who said voting for this is signing the death warrant for the caucus convention system, and the governor said he doesn't think that's the case.
He also said there needs to be some modifications.
He ended up supporting. He signed the bill, and he says he's going to go through the convention system, and he thinks it's going to survive and hopefully be strengthened by this legislation. As Holly put it, time will tell, and we've got until 2016 before we actually see the
well, and I don't think it'll be immediate, right? I mean, my prediction is that you will see the first cycle in 2016. People will do the dual track maybe in 2018. You start to get to 2020 and 2022, you're going to have people start, I think, going to the signature route rather than the convention route. But we'll see. I mean, the bar is pretty high.
Yeah.
But
And the first test for this might be Senator Mike Lee.
Well, that's
right?
what I was going to ask.
I mean, 28,000 signatures is what you'd need statewide.
Right.
That is a high
bar. That's a high bar.
And it'll be interesting to see if anybody steps in and tries to take out an incumbent senator in this mm-hmm. in the first go around.
Mm-hmm. Lee told Thomas Burr of the Tribune that he's willing to play in the system and he intends to win in the mm-hmm. system. I mean, do you have any sense that there's going to be a challenge to Senator Lee?
I think almost certainly.
Yeah, I mean, there have been rumblings out there. Nobody's stepped up and said they will, but it's still a ways off.
Well, that's the question by establishment Republicans. Will yeah. there be a mm-hmm. challenge? Holly, are you getting any – do you have any names?
No, only rumor mill at this point. And, you just expect – I mean, most of the time, especially if you've got people who are unhappy in large numbers, that you'll have a challenger. But not always. I mean, sometimes – again, it'll remain to be seen. People – thought Chris Stewart would have a strong challenger this time. I don't see it happening. I don't know if you guys do, but I think he's, going to do well in his reelection bid.
Here's a comment. I'm so disappointed in the new state tree.
how could you be disappointed by the new state tree?
It's a junk tree, man. It's a junk tree.
You know what? If you have one in your yard, they are obnoxious. Yeah.
Quaking aspens are beautiful to look at in the wild, this person says, but in a controlled environment like your yard or garden, they mm-hmm. behave more like noxious
preach
weeds.
Preach it, sister.
The blue spruce is a fine tree. Why the change?
Well, the talk was this is the Colorado blue spruce.
I know.
How could, well, we also
have a California goal.
I was going to say, is that going to happen next year?
I grew up in Utah, and none of my textbooks said Colorado blue spruce. They all said blue spruce. You know, I was shocked when I found out the whole thing.
In defense of the aspen briefly, Senator Jones made an interesting point when she was talking about the aspen, is that all of their root system is interconnected. And she said that's a nice symbol for Utah because we're all interconnected.
Well, that's why you can't get rid of them. The world's largest organism.
It's true. It's true.
One big clump of aspen.
How much taffy did you eat this session, Robert Durkee?
273 pieces of taffy this year.
Okay, I kept track of mine. I had four the entire session.
Well, between the two of us, that's 277 pieces of taffy.
So there you go.
Robert Durkee, you pointed out in the paper that more than a fourth of the members of the Democratic caucus of the legislature is retiring, which leads me to this question I want to finally have you work through. As we're running out of time, what's the legislature going to look like after that, or what's it going to look like next year? Where are we headed?
Well, between the turnover, we've had high turnover the last few cycles, it seems. Yeah. And now you're seeing not just the five Democrats who are leaving, but six Republicans. Yeah. So you're seeing over 10% turnover there.
And women.
And we're losing five women. I think it's obviously going to look very different. I think it's going to be much younger than it has been in the past, and less experienced maybe. Hmm. And partisan wise, most of these districts are fairly safe. But Janice Fisher's district is a true toss up district, I think.
Yeah. And
Pat
Cosgrove.
Jones,
yeah.
Cosgrove, and even Pat Jones' district could be interesting. Senator Reed's district could be interesting. So it'll be a very different, much younger, and probably less experienced body next year when we're back.
Speaker, any candidates rising to the top?
You know, a lot of people talk about Jim Dunnigan. He took on some tough jobs this year, most notably the Swallow investigation. Yeah.
Brad D.
Brad D. has been the majority leader.
Mm-hmm. I'm hearing Greg Hughes potentially.
Greg Hughes could step in there and run. I'd heard Mel Brown early was looking at trying to. He's a former speaker.
Of course.
And was looking at doing it again. Francis Gibson and Brad Wilson are talked about for leadership positions. I don't know if they're going to run for speaker or whip or further down. You know, and Ibsen, Representative Ibsen. Is possible.
Ibsen's not running for speaker.
No, not for speaker,
but leadership,
but for a leadership position. Yeah. So I think Brad D. seems to be the front runner. I think at this point.
So will it be in terms of anything significant, any difference really in major ways from the way it has been, really? Is it always going to be this way?
like we said at the beginning of this conversation, that the tone this year was set by the Speaker of the House. There's no question that this session was defined by Becky Lockhart, and so that's a powerful chair to hold. And there have been times where there's been serious friction between the Senate and the House, largely because of personality
leadership.
Issues with leadership.
Mm-hmm.
That is Max Roth. He's a reporter and anchor for Fox 13 News. Max, thanks very much.
Thank you.
For joining us. Holly Richardson, of course, former state lawmaker, running again. Not sure why you're doing that, but thanks for joining
us. It's an illness.
Maybe that's how the legislature will be different.
We'll have Holly there. Robert Durkee, thanks.
Thank you.
And Brian Grimmett, thank you.
You're welcome.
Much. Radio West, production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our theme music composed by The Moth and the Flame. Radio West is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.